there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 261. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is, of course, This Show Is So Gay. And, of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. A jam-packed show for you this week. We must get started. My apologies, I'm a little bit under the weather, so my voice is coming and going, but as they used to say on vaudeville, the gay radio show must go on. We bring to you our first guest. Nathan Schaefer is the executive director of the Empire State Pride Agenda and the Empire State Pride Agenda Foundation. Prior to his tenure at the Pride Agenda, he served as the director of public policy for GMHC. He was also the government relations associate at AIDS Alliance for Children, Youth, and Families in Washington, D.C., and he was the director of education at public policy at the AIDS Task Force of Greater Cleveland, right here in Cleveland, Ohio. Nathan, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So much to chat about. Are you ready, sir?
I am.
Word on the street is that you grew up on a farm, Nathan.
I did. I grew up on a small farm near Sandusky, Ohio. I went to college and grad school in Ohio, so I am a Midwestern boy at heart.
Now, I went the other direction. I am a New Yorker who now lives in Ohio. What do I need know? I know. What do I need to know about my new Midwestern home?
Well, you need to know where University Circle is.
Got it.
That is probably one of my favorite parts of Cleveland. You need to know Coventry and Cleveland Heights, and you need to know where the closest Target is.
I have all of those things down. I'm kind of excited. Now, what about Cedar Point? Because that's like your hometown.
That is my hometown. I used to go to Cedar Point in the summertime. We had season passes as kids once I was a teenager. My parents loved to drop me off there and let me run around all day. And I worked at the TGI Fridays all throughout college, just off the causeway going into Cedar Point.
Wow. Do they have some sort of Nathan Schaefer discount if I go and mention your name?
You should try. I don't know of any official discount, but they probably know. There is also, they have gay dates at Cedar Point. It actually often coincides with Father's Day.
Okay.
Which I always thought was a little bit problematic because I always wanted to spend the day with Dad and I didn't necessarily want to go to Cedar Point. So, in any event, it's in early June and I know it's a lot of fun.
I will most assuredly check it out. I've not yet been there. All right, so then you went to school here in Ohio and you did your graduate school in Ohio. Where was that turning point for you when you said, all right, I am just going to throw myself into nonprofit work?
It all started when I went to graduate school for social work and I was studying at Case Western Reserve University. And I remember the advisor at the time asking me where I wanted to do my internship. And I said I wasn't exactly sure what kind of social work I wanted to practice, but that I wanted to work with gay and lesbian people. And her advice was to go to the AIDS Task Force of Greater Cleveland. And my immediate reaction was, well, it's not that HIV is the only thing that confronts the gay and lesbian community, but in any event, I'll go and check it out. And I immediately fell in love. It was not only a organization that did and does really, really great work, but I was able to be myself, to be fully gay and open and out at work. And I immediately realized that I had a passion for helping others within the community. And I, in my second year, identified an opportunity to work within public policy and within government. And it's been a love fest ever since.
We've had so many different executive directors on the show and certainly so many different folks who are doing nonprofit work, and a lot of them have a law background. What do you bring to the table in coming at this from a totally different lens?
I think what I bring as someone who is a social worker is compassion and empathy for the people that we are trying to serve. I think I have a keen understanding of the complexities facing the LGBT community. And while you're accurate, many folks do have a law degree, and I certainly have to interact with lawyers and with politicians and in drafting legislation, but I think I have a connection, a personal and professional connection to those that we're trying to serve that helps me do my work well.
Nice. And what gets you excited about doing this work? We love tapping into these passions. You clearly have made a career of doing public policy work. What keeps you going?
I think what is especially motivating is that you see incremental victories time and time again. And it's so exciting right now to be a professional homosexual in the advocacy movement as we continue to see more and more states achieve marriage equality. Just this week with Oregon and with Pennsylvania,
yeah,
we're now up to, what, 18 states? So when you see progress, when you see that your efforts are building momentum and contributing to a larger nationwide movement, it's incredibly compelling to continue the work.
Well, as I mentioned in your bio, you did just incredible work at GMHC. Why go to work for GMHC?
I went to work for GMHC because they were known as the nation's first and one of the largest aid service providers, but they also always had a very strong public policy and advocacy arm of what they did.
Yeah.
So I applied to be the director of public policy while I was still living in Cleveland, and frankly never actually thought I would get a call in response. So I was so excited for the opportunity to come to a city that I always wanted to live in and work for such a reputable organization, and had a very fruitful 5 years there.
I think saying very fruitful actually does not do it justice. Some really incredible victories at GMHC while you were there.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we did see, we changed the HIV testing law in New York State so that every patient would be offered an HIV test when they would go to routinely see their doctor. We always advocated for more and more resources for people living with HIV. And a project that I was especially proud of was pertaining to the Food and Drug Administration's policy on gay and bisexual men donating blood. We saw a lot of pressure, a lot of progress. The government, unfortunately, still hasn't adopted or amended that policy to date, but I was very proud of all of our efforts.
Anybody who's listened to the show at any point in the past 6 years knows that that is by far my pet issue, that that's the one I'm obsessed with, is blood donation. And we talk about it so often on the show, and nobody seems to have the answer, Nathan, on what we can do about that.
I think that there is there's a very recent alternative policy that I have been advocating for years, and I just saw implemented this week in the third country, and that's in South Africa. What I routinely pressure the FDA with is an argument that what we should not be doing is screening donors based on their sexual orientation. Instead, you actually have to get at the high-risk behavior of not only gay and bisexual men, but of heterosexual people as well. Under current policy, if you're straight and you have had sex with hundreds of partners within the past year, unprotected sex, not only can you donate blood, they don't even ask you about that behavior. Yet if you're a gay man who had sex, oral sex, one time in 1987 with a condom, you'd be permanently deferred. So the alternative policy that I have been advocating for is we should be asking all donors, regardless of their sexual orientation, about sex within the past 6 months, and if they have had multiple partners within the past 6 months, to be temporarily deferred. This would get at, it would allow gay men who are either in monogamous relationships or who have not been recently sexually active, and it would also decrease the potential risk from high-risk heterosexual donors who are permitted to donate under the current policy.
I'm under the weather this week, and I would like some hope. Can we think that this blood donation policy is going to change soon?
I think we will see incremental change. I think we will see the U.S. government adopt an alternative policy. I don't think it will be this model that I just articulated, because
okay,
the Food and Drug Administration moves incredibly slow.
Yeah.
What I do think they will do next is implement something like the United Kingdom has recently done, which is a one-year deferral. So if you haven't had sex within the past 12 months, they would allow you to donate blood. I don't think that that's a suitable alternative policy, because it still doesn't get to the high-risk heterosexual activity that I was just speaking about.
Right. All right. We're going to keep our eye on that. So
yep,
at some point you saw a job ad. I would assume you saw some sort of job ad, and apparently Empire State Pride Agenda had a small opening for an executive director. Is that how this came about?
Yeah. It came at the recommendation of some colleagues.
Good.
When the opportunity presented itself to apply to be the executive director of New York State's LGBT statewide advocacy organization. And I thought to myself, I'm not sure I'm ready for that. But I went for it, and I couldn't be happier with the move. It's an incredible organization. The staff, the volunteers, the board are so incredibly dedicated. It is a great place to work.
Give us the bullet points. As an organization, what are your prime foci?
So right now, it's the end of May, and our focus presently is on the New York State Legislature. They are a part-time legislature, so they convene between January and June. And I'll tell you what we're advocating for passage in this legislative session. We're advancing and prioritizing three pieces of legislation. The first is called the Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, or GENDA. We do not have statewide protections for transgender New Yorkers, so they face discrimination at every turn. Almost 18 other states currently have protections for transgender residents. New York State does not. So that's our top legislative priority. Another is similar to a piece of legislation that has been introduced in Ohio and a handful of other states, is a ban on conversion therapy that is used on LGBT minors. It's an unfortunate reality that in 2014, this is still occurring, and there are therapists who try and turn gay kids straight or try and turn trans youth into something that they are not. So we hope to be able to pass that legislation that would prohibit the practice in the state of New York.
Nice.
And the third and probably the most complicated piece of legislation is called the Child Parent Security Act. And it would fundamentally do two things. First, dramatically improve the process for second parent adoption, which for many members of our community, when they are not the biological parent to their child, go through incredible obstacles to have the legal guardianship for their family. And in addition, it would legalize surrogacy arrangements in New York State. New York State is one of four states where you cannot work with a what's called a gestational carrier or a surrogate to create your family. So for New York couples, gay or straight, who want to work with a surrogate, they have to travel outside of the state, sometimes as far as California, multiple times to create their family. So for a lot of those reasons and more, we're pushing for the Child Parent Security Act this legislative session as well.
That's a full slate of projects.
Yeah, it is. And they're all very different issues. So, and the way things work in Albany and in many state legislators is, you know, we're lobbyists because we stand in the lobby literally and wait for people to come by. And then you know, politely try and get their attention. And so you have to be very nimble and you have to be able to speak to specific legislators with specific talking points based on what you want them to do on each of these issues. And you have different allies on each of these issues. The Child Parent Security Act that I was just mentioning doesn't only apply to the LGBT community. So we have a really diverse and unique coalition of supporters on that.
Lest our listeners make any assumptions, New York is an extraordinarily complex state. You know, as someone who lived there for many, many years, yes, of course, you have New York City, but then you have, you know, the whole Rockland County where I grew up and that kind of ethos and Westchester where I lived for a while. And then I don't even know anything about upstate other than what I read. I would imagine navigating New York State is extraordinarily complex.
It is. It really, really is. It's an incredibly diverse state. And while almost half of the population resides in New York City and in the New York metropolitan area, there is there's a huge diversity of political persuasion and people's experiences across the state. Upstate, when you go north of Albany and you get up into the Adirondack State Park, it is incredibly conservative and not densely populated whatsoever. When you move to the west, in western New York, you have the next two biggest cities, Buffalo and Rochester. And you don't get anything done, I will tell you, in Albany without some support, some significant support of Western New Yorkers. I just returned last weekend. The Pride Agenda held our largest upstate fundraiser. It's actually New York State's largest LGBT event in Rochester. We had 525 people come out
to
celebrate all of our recent victories this past Saturday. So there's a huge base of progressive, committed, dedicated LGBT folks in Rochester and allies. Over half of the people that come to our spring dinner in Rochester are allies of our community, and it's so refreshing to see their support.
I would imagine it's quite also quite complicated to be doing this type of work in a state that does have marriage equality. You know, in some ways, I think about, well, being an executive director of an advocacy organization in a place like Ohio, where that's on everybody's minds of, yeah, we're not even close to that, it seems, right now. But when you're in a state with marriage equality, I think you did well, and there's a YouTube video of you speaking about this, that really challenging everyone's complacency to not say, okay, just because we have this doesn't mean we are where we need to be.
You hit the nail on the head. It is incredibly challenging. What has been very important for the organization to do is to continue to reiterate the unique and the everyday realities of LGBT New Yorkers. So we know that we're not done yet. We know that young people are preyed upon with these kinds of conversion efforts that cause irreparable damage. We know that more and more same-sex couples want to create and protect their families, so they need a legal framework in order to be able to do so. And with GENDA, we still don't have basic fundamental protections from discrimination for residents within our state. That is completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
So by no means are we done.
Yeah. Talk to me about you as an executive director. How would you describe how you tackle this role?
With commitment. I mean, the thing about being an executive director is you have to be fully present in every moment for everyone with whom you're interacting. And you have to be able to interact with committed and sometimes frustrated activists. You have to be able to interact with major supporters and possibly with politicians on a dime or with media interviews. So you have to be fully present all the time, and you have to be incredibly committed and dedicated to the mission of the organization, which I fully am.
Good.
And I have to oftentimes remind myself of the incremental progress that we are seeing, because policy change doesn't happen quickly. I know that seems counterintuitive when we think about all of the recent marriage victories, but in order to pass a piece of legislation, in order to change someone's perspective on any given issue, it does sometimes move slower than we would like. So we have to remind ourselves of the progress that we see time and again.
And, you know, as we've talked about so many times over the years, there are setbacks, right? And so we have to navigate those setbacks. How do you propel yourself forward when we have those inevitable setbacks?
I think you have to remind yourself that for every setback, you also have some kind of victory.
Right.
And it might not be of the magnitude that you would have liked or that you had anticipated. But for every setback, there is some kind of progress, and it does move forward. And when you look, when we think about the national movement and we think about all of the victories that we've had in recent decades, it is very clear that progress is moving forward, that the needle only goes future towards equality and justice. We are getting there. We are absolutely getting there. So we just have to remind ourselves of the larger picture and see that we are changing.
I would feel remiss if I didn't at least give a shout out to the fact that you are breaking the mold in being a national leader on these issues under 40. And that's not something, look, as a college professor and someone who is constantly pushing my students to embrace this work and really challenge the ideas of who it is that can sit at the table, you very much are breaking that mold. I would imagine you're in any number of meetings where you're probably one of the youngest people there.
Yes, I am a young leader, and I'm very proud of that.
Yeah.
I would say two things about how I think I was able to do that. First, I was able at an early age, as I said, when I was studying social work, and I began to intern at the AIDS Task Force of Greater Cleveland, and I realized that I had a passion for a combination of service delivery and public policy as it pertained to the LGBT community. So I, at a very early age, identified something that was incredibly motivating and that made me a very driven person. And the other thing is I have had phenomenal and tremendous mentors along the way.
Nice.
One of them being Tracy Jones, who's the executive director at the AIDS Task Force of Greater Cleveland. And it is incredibly important for young people to establish mentorship, to find people that we look up to and ask them to mentor us along the way, because I have had to make significant life-changing decision, sometimes quickly, and I've had the benefit of consultation with people whose opinion and whose advice I really, really trust. And I think as young professionals, you have to have that if you want to be successful.
Yeah. You know, I spent the last few years living in Vermont, and one of the conversations we often had in Vermont was how it often felt quite insular. You know, we had made such great strides for LGBT equality in Vermont, but you had some surrounding states that weren't doing as well, weren't making the same progress. What responsibility do you feel and what opportunities do you have to work with your neighbors?
Yeah, you know, we don't do enough. We don't do enough work with our partners in neighboring states. I would say that there are two opportunities a year when I am able to convene with my colleagues from other statewide LGBT advocacy organizations. And one of those is at the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Creating Change, which happens in January. The other is a newer organization called the Equality Federation. And they convene in the summer, this year it's in Minneapolis, a meeting of folks who work on statewide LGBT advocacy. It's such a refreshing opportunity to surround yourself with colleagues who do similar things, who have similar ventures, and who might be advancing similar pieces of legislation. With the conversion bill that I spoke of, you know, it's been introduced in a handful of states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Massachusetts. So I'm hoping to convene with my colleagues from those organizations that represent those states, and we can sort of brainstorm and troubleshoot in terms of what's worked for them, what hasn't, and how we can apply that to our work.
Nice. Well, if I can put you in a category of you people, of the executive directors who we have on the show, the one thing I worry about you people is that you don't take some time away from the job. Is that something that he just chuckled and that makes me worried right there, Nathan? Do you get time away?
I try very hard to.
That's good.
I try very hard to. Yeah, it's funny. Last summer, I planned to take a week off, and I went up to the Adirondack State Park with my partner and with a couple of friends, and I intentionally chose a place that did not have cell phone reception, and I told everyone I'm going to be unavailable. And then I got there and went into the cabin and realized that they had Wi-Fi, and I was like, oh, crap. So I tried. I actually intentionally looked for a place where I thought I could disconnect and blast. I could not. But I am going to take some time this summer. I mean, as in any sort of government operation kind of job, things really slow down in July and especially in August. June, of course, is Pride Month. It's end of the legislative session. It's
right.
The New York City budget process. So come July and August, I do hope to rejuvenate a little bit.
I am not downplaying the beauty of the Adirondacks, but I do want to remind you that there are 49 other states out there.
Yes, I know. I know this. I will be there in Ohio in early June. I run the race out on Kelly's Island each year, and I do that with my father. I'm really looking forward to doing that with him and some really good friends. And then I'm going to spend a long weekend over the 4th of July out in Provincetown in Massachusetts.
Nice.
And we go there every summer, and I adore the place. It's so special. So I will. I will do some traveling.
I've never been to Provincetown. How is that possible?
I don't know, especially if you lived on the East Coast. It is such a special place, and it's got such a history, you know, of our community being there. And the thing about it is you go there, and it's not – I mean, it's everywhere is gay, but everywhere is gay and straight welcoming. It's like, you know, when you go to a city and you try and find a place, and they say, well, this place is gay-friendly. Like, everywhere in T-Town is either gay or straight-friendly. And I love it. I love it. It's one of my favorite places.
I got to check it out. Well, I want to talk really quick about the fundraising aspect of what you do. I just feel like sometimes when we have these conversations or when I'm talking to my students about social justice or anyone in the community, this is the topic that it's almost taboo. It's like, yes, we can talk about what we want to achieve, but let's not talk about the strategies by which we raise the funds to achieve some of these things. What do you embrace in order to get those funds rolling in, which really enables so much movement forward?
You know, one of the things that we do really well at the Pride Agenda and have a long history of doing is throwing fundraisers, throwing special events that allow the community to come together to contribute to our efforts but to also get to know a little bit more about what we're doing and to enjoy themselves and to surround themselves with community members. And it's important that we do this. You mentioned New York being a very diverse state. It is. And I mentioned we were just in Rochester. In early June, we will have an event in the Hudson Valley. There's an increasing LGBT community in that area of the state. And in July, we have an event out in the Hamptons. Our Hamptons Tea Dance is our second largest fundraiser of the year. And then in October, we raise $1 million, which is almost a third of our budget in one evening. We have a fall dinner. This year it is on October 16th, I believe. And if it weren't for that event, we would not be able to continue our operations. Thankfully, we have been doing it for many years, and it's known to be such an exciting evening that the community has come to expect it. And there's a base of support that helps pull the dinner off each year. And without the support of all of the community, we would not be successful in doing so.
And you get to get all gussied up.
There you go.
There you go. It's always a good thing. How about youth involvement in all the work that you're doing? Where are those entry points for the younger folks who want to get involved?
Sure. So there's really two ways that I think we reach youth really well. The first is in April each year, we have an Equality and Justice Day, which is a convening of advocates and providers and supporters from all over the state who convene in Albany and lobby on our legislative priorities. Every year, we bring over 700 folks there. There are so many young people who come out, and for many of them, it's their first opportunity to interact with an elected official, which can be an incredibly powerful and empowering encounter. We also have a network of providers across the state called the LGBT Health and Human Services Network. It's over 50 providers that provide health and human service needs to the LGBT community, and collectively they provide services to almost 1 million New Yorkers in every corner of the state annually. And those providers, most of them, do youth outreach really, really well. So that's some of our opportunities where young people get involved.
Love it. Love it. Well, my favorite point always to end with executive directors, people doing the work that you do. I give you the floor, sir, to extol the virtues of your staff, your volunteers, your board. The floor is yours.
Sure. Thank you. No, I honestly wouldn't be able to be successful as an executive director. The Empire State Pride Agenda would not be successful as an organization if I didn't have the backing and support of every member of the staff whose dedication is tremendous. The board of directors who trusted me, a young professional in this role, and has stood by me every step of the way and even through some very challenging moments. And of course, the broader community. If we didn't have the support, not only of everybody in New York State, but of everyone within the community that knows what we're up to and wants to support us. So a huge, profound thank you to everyone who has believed in me and continues to believe in the Pride Agenda. We remain very, very appreciative of everyone's support.
And at this point in the conversation, I feel a duty to let you know that your board has asked that we use this conversation as your annual review. So that's a good thing. It's a good thing.
I love it. Oh, please do, yeah.
No paperwork for you, sir. Well, everyone should stroll on over to prideagenda.org. Just stroll on over, prideagenda.org. Learn all about the amazing work that's happening at Empire State Pride Agenda. Nathan, it's been such a pleasure to just read about everything that you guys are doing in New York. I know you have an incredible staff, incredible volunteers, incredible board, and I know intimately just what a complex state it is. And you all are just navigating it so deftly while still just pushing ahead and seeing more and more goals to achieve. And it sounds like quite a full legislative session in front of you all, but I really look forward to just reading more and more accomplishments and everything that you and everyone at Empire State Pride Agenda is doing. It's really great to read.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We'll definitely keep you updated, and we'll all share in the victory together.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Nathan.
You bet.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, if my voice holds out and this cold stays in abeyance and my NyQuil does not kick in mid-sentence, well, then we have a lot of LGBT news and my own views to share with you all on this week's episode. First, I am fulfilling a promise. I made a little bit of a promise there on Facebook. I had a promotional campaign going. As I've said before, I am headed out next week to California to participate for my fourth time with AIDS Life Cycle, the bike ride from San Francisco to LA. And to be clear, I am not going to be on a bike riding from San Francisco to LA. I put out these fundraising calls, and as much as I try to make it clear to folks that for this ride, for AIDS Life Cycle in California, I am a roadie. I am working a gear truck with amazing people, and we're loading and unloading bags all day long and lugging them up and down the California Coastway in a truck. We're not actually putting them on our backs. The ride that I do where I'm actually in the bike saddle is at the end of the summer, and that's Charity Treks, and you should check them out. Charity Treks, TREKS.org, and that's the ride from Burlington, Vermont, over to Portland, Maine. So for AIDS Life Cycle in California, I'm a roadie. And so when people say, oh, I'm totally going to give you money because I can't believe you're going to be biking from San Francisco to LA, I have to say, no, thank you for the money, but I'm not actually doing that. Well, my campaign this year was to just get 100 friends and family to donate $10 each just to raise a cool and even grand there for the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and the LA Gay and Lesbian Center, two amazing organizations that are both servicing folks who are living with HIV and AIDS, but also they are doing some great research. And we talked about that a little last year when we had one of the researchers, Chris Brown, on the show. Not that Chris Brown, but the Chris Brown who's actually doing HIV and AIDS research. What I put out there yesterday was that if folks gave me $10 yesterday, if they donated there on AIDSLifeCycle.org, I would give them a shout out on the show. So now I got to follow through on that happily. So here are my shout outs. It's a little bit long, but we'll get through them quickly. Shout out to Julie, amazing sociology professor at Baldwin Wallace. Thank you so much, Julie. Thank you to Leah, who I think didn't want a shout out, but I don't really care because she's getting one. And she's also an amazing sociology professor at Baldwin Wallace. Thank you to Jeremy Crabb, who I met on last year's AIDS Life Cycle. He's an amazing cyclist, also working in university life. Thank you. Bianca, amazing bartender here in Cleveland. Thank you, Bianca. Shannon, who I grew up with, who we went to high school together. She came through with a donation. Nicole Curvin, who I adore, used to work with her at Marlboro College, one of the best deans of admissions around. Thank you so much. Eddie, here in Cleveland. Eddie works for the Cleveland Mediation Center. He contributed. Thanks, Eddie. Brian Wagner, an old student affairs friend who I have not seen in like decades, Brian Wagner, but he came through with a donation. Caleb, who's my new tennis friend here in Cleveland, he donated. And finally to Lauren, my hairstylist. She was my stylist in Brattleboro, Vermont. She came through with a donation. Lauren, I will tell you, this was not supposed to be part of the shout out, but I miss your hairstyling so much. Lauren had this deal, everybody, and you should go to her. She's in Brattleboro, Vermont. She's at the Aveda Salon there in Brattleboro, Enright & Company, free plug, Enright & Company, and she had this thing where if I was in the chair less than 15 minutes, it was only $15, and I keep my hair pretty short. So it was always $15, and it was a great haircut, and I can't seem to find that here in Cleveland. So Lauren, I missed you terribly. I almost want to take your donation and use it to go back to Vermont so I can get my $15 haircut, but it's going to a good cause. It's going to AIDS Life Cycle. So those are my shout-outs. If you want to contribute, there's still time. There's still another week. You can stroll on over to AIDSLifeCycle.org. You can either search for me, Ken Schneck, or you can search for anybody you want and support them. So that is what's going on there. Also, before we get to the real LGBT news, I will just say X-Men coming out this weekend, not necessarily a gay story, but I kind of think it is a gay story. And actually, there's an op-ed on advocate.com that further explains how X-Men, for many of us, is one big LGBT allegory. And it certainly was for me growing up, that whole idea where you have this group of misfits, these people who are different, but they have special powers and they're just special in general, but society doesn't understand them at all. So X-Men coming out this weekend, so excited to go see X-Men. Although I will say, yeah, all of that Bryan Singer stuff, the director of X-Men, who has all these accusations leveled against him, that's kind of irksome. and troubling on so many different levels. I don't actually think it's going to affect the box office. Bryan Singer made the decision a few weeks ago that he would stay out of the press. He wouldn't do any interviews for the movie. He was accused of hosting these underage sex parties or pressuring young actors into having sex, and he would promise them roles or just special favors. And so all of these different accusations, I don't think it's going to affect the box office, but happily he has remained out of the press. Yeah, very troubling. Very troubling there with Bryan Singer. And I will say, now, I don't know Bryan Singer. I have never hung out with Bryan Singer. I've never had Bryan Singer on the show. I've never been invited to one of Bryan Singer's underage sex parties. Allegedly. He had them, allegedly. But I do know people who, dated him. And I do know, some people in Hollywood. And this whole Bryan Singer thing, and I'm not telling tales out of school. You can find any number of op-eds about this, or just look in the comment section of any of these Bryan Singer articles. It's kind of an open secret that Bryan Singer is a little bit creepy, allegedly. Allegedly creepy. But X-Men, still amazing. Hopefully he did it justice. I'm sure it's going to be amazing. I will see it this weekend. If you're in Cleveland and want to see it with me, drop me a line. Ken at thisshowisogay.com. So there's that. I will also say, also in the entertainment news, and I'm kind of weaning myself off of Modern Family. It's funny. I am not watching it any less than I did. I still watch every episode. I don't feel like I'm as emotionally invested in Modern Family. I don't laugh as hard as I used to, and yet I still watch every single episode. But I will say that last night I watched the marriage episode, part two of the marriage episode. I got all kinds of choked up. Mitch and Cam finally tied the knot. Yes, of course, it's Modern Family, so hijinks ensued. But there was this one part, spoiler alert. I've never done a spoiler alert on my show. I can't imagine that I would need to, but I'm going to. A spoiler alert, where Mitch walks down the aisle with his dad and Gloria, and Mitch puts his head on his dad's shoulder, and it was just such a moment for me. It was a really beautiful moment. So if you've not checked out the marriage episodes, part one and part two of Modern Family, they're over there on really any internet station. You can easily watch them. The Advocate has a piece right now, 11 Reasons Mitchell and Cameron Belong Together. I don't know if this is in response to something. Are people saying that Mitchell and Cameron shouldn't be together? I do not know. But The Advocate's got a piece called 11 Reasons Mitchell and Cameron Belong Together. And they just got married. They're on Modern Family, which is what couples all across the nation are doing. All across the nation, couples are getting married. It has been quite the eventful weeks. I mean, gosh, it's been quite the eventful year for marriage equality. But certainly it's ramped up even more this week. Try to do it in chronological order. First, the ruling striking down Oregon's ban on marriage equality, that took effect this past week. State officials indicated they would not appeal the ruling. At the time, though this has since changed, at the time the ruling was the 13th judicial reversal of a state marriage ban since the U.S. Supreme Court ruling last June that invalidated parts of the Defense of Marriage Act. So Judge Michael McShane, who was the judge on this case, this is what he said, quote, "I believe that if we can look for a moment past gender and sexuality, we can see in these plaintiffs nothing more or less than our own families." Right? Beautiful quote, right? Except in all of these articles, after the end quote, it reads, "Judge Michael McShane, who is openly gay, wrote in his decision." I don't get the whole highlighting that he's openly gay. I don't get it. In all of the other cases and all of the other judicial reversals where the judges were not gay, it did not read, said Judge Adler, who, and there wasn't one, I'm just making up a name, said Judge Adler, who was openly straight. He wrote that in his decision. So it makes it seem like when Judge McShane said this, and I'll read it again, when Judge McShane wrote this, quote, "I believe that if we can look for a moment past gender and sexuality, we can see in these plaintiffs nothing more or less than our own families," it makes it seem like, oh, but he's only saying that because he's gay. And maybe, well, when he's saying our own families, that's because he's gay. And also he's openly gay. And so it just leaves this little bitty tiny room that this isn't a valid judicial decision, that it's tainted by the individual's own bias, and that's such bull. That is such bull. So all the AP stories, every story out there highlights, oh yeah, Judge Michael McShane, openly gay. So what do you do with that, people reading it? Because obviously that affected his opinion. It's just annoying. So you might have some of these other judges who were even more personally invested than Judge Michael McShane. The point is, we don't say that piece because it doesn't affect their judicial ruling. Their judicial ruling is based on the law. It's based on the law. It's based on the Constitution. It's based on interpretations of the law, not interpretations of their own sexual orientation. Very frustrated with my media colleagues who have highlighted that. But I just went to the bad place. We got to come back to the good place, because in the good place, there's still more marriage equality things happening. In Utah, a federal judge has ruled that Utah must recognize all same-sex marriages that were performed in the state after that December ruling in Utah struck down the state's marriage equality ban. Roughly 1,300 couples wed in the state before the U.S. Supreme Court halted the issuances of licenses pending an appeal by the state. The ruling is set to take effect in the next 15-16 days, so that's happening in Utah. And then the big news in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, a federal judge has ruled that Pennsylvania's law prohibiting same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional. Governor Tom Corbett has now said he will not be appealing this ruling, so Pennsylvania will now be the 19th state with marriage equality. And get this stat, listeners, nearly 44% of the U.S. population, when this goes into effect in Pennsylvania, nearly 44% of the U.S. population will live in states where same-sex couples have the right to marry. That's pretty close to 51%, which is a majority. And by the way, even though a majority of Americans do not live in states with same-sex marriage, every polling data out there indicates that the vast, vast majority of Americans support same-sex marriage. Evan Wolfson, he was on the show years and years and years ago. He's president of Freedom to Marry. He said this quote, "Today's win in Pennsylvania finally brings the freedom to marry to the entire Northeast. Loving and committed couples and their families in the nation's sixth largest state will be able to share in the joy, security, and dignity that comes with the freedom to marry. The stone that was once left out has become the keystone, and now it's time to finish the job nationwide." Great quote. Great quote from Evan Wolfson. So we will keep our eyes on all of these states. There's action apparently in Montana. Loyal listeners of the show, you know I love Montana. I wrote my sixth grade project on Montana. We had to pick a state. I chose Montana, the treasure state. And I'm convinced, even though I can't find it anymore, maybe it's in my parents' house somewhere, but I'm convinced that the governor of Montana wrote me a letter personally that said, "Thank you for doing your sixth grade project on Montana." I'm really proud of that. I don't know that he wrote it personally, but I think that he did. Maybe he signed it, or an aide signed it. But Montana, action on marriage equality. We're going to keep our eyes on Montana as well. Well, there are any number of stories that we cover here on this show, So Gay, and within about 5 seconds of me saying them, they're out of date. I mean, right now, I could have just said that about Montana, and by the time you hear this, whenever that is, Montana will have legalized marriage equality. So any number of stories that I put out there that change. A couple of the stories that we covered on our last original episode a few weeks ago, they changed dramatically since the last time I covered them. Nintendo had said, "Look, we're not a social justice organization. We don't have platforms. But even though we don't take a stand on issues, we are saying that our new virtual reality game, Tamagotchi Life, you will not be able to be in a same-sex relationship." So even though they were saying we don't take a stand on issues, they were taking a stand on an issue by saying we will not allow you to be in a relationship with someone of the same sex in our virtual reality game. Well, they've since reversed that decision and they've said, yeah, you know what? Play our game. Buy our game. If you buy our game, we'll totally allow the option where you can be engaged in a relationship with someone of the same sex. So that completely changed there at Nintendo. And then in North Carolina. So what we had said last time, what we covered on the show, because it was the story at the time, it's since changed quite dramatically, was that Clay Aiken was likely going to be in a runoff with his chief opponent for the Democratic primary for Congress in North Carolina. He was going to be in a runoff with Keith Crisco. Well, unbelievably and oh so tragically, Keith Crisco has unfortunately passed away. And so Clay Aiken will no longer be in a runoff with Keith Crisco. And in fact, it has since been counted that Clay Aiken won the required 40% of the vote, so he probably was going to avoid that runoff election. Clay Aiken will now be running against Clay Aiken, runner-up on American Idol, runner-up on Celebrity Apprentice. He's now running for Congress. He will be in that general election. He's running against Renee Elmers. Renee Elmers is a two-term incumbent Republican congresswoman. Now, the Human Rights Campaign, if you do not know, and you should know this because you should look up your representatives wherever you are, they have a scorecard there on their website where they rate all of our politicians, and it's from 0 to 100. And you can either be very good on LGBT issues and get 100, or you could get a 0, which some folks have, including Renee Elmers, the two-term incumbent Republican congresswoman. That's right. She has a 0% score on the Human Rights Campaign's legislative scorecards. She has supported several pieces of legislation to deny LGBT people the right to marriage, and she has not co-sponsored any of the LGBT supportive rights bills that were introduced into Congress this session. So that is who Clay Aiken is running against. Clay Aiken has done the classy and oh-so-appropriate thing. He is suspending his activities. He is suspending his campaign activities for this congressional seat in North Carolina following the death of Keith Crisco. He said this, quote, "Keith Crisco was a gentleman, a good and honorable man, and an extraordinary public servant. I was honored to know him. I am suspending all campaign activities as we pray for his family and friends." So that is the classy thing to do. So he is suspending his activities. We should not put out there that Clay Aiken is not without his detractors in the LGBT community. Andy Hum, the co-host of Gay USA, he was on the show a few months back. He had some scathing comments about Clay Aiken there on the Facebook. Clay Aiken apparently was asked about marriage equality, and his answer, I don't have it in front of me, but his answer was something to the effect of, yeah, not the most important issue right now to the voters in this North Carolina district. And Andy Hum blasted him and said, you know what? You're not in that position where you decide what's most important, what's least important. These things are not mutually exclusive. So Clay Aiken, not without his detractors, but a clear alternative to Renee Elmers, the two-term incumbent Republican congresswoman who has scored a whopping goose egg on the Human Rights Campaign's legislative scorecard. Can't wait to see what happens there in North Carolina. Adam Carolla. We move now to Adam Carolla. So Adam Carolla is a comedian. He too was on Celebrity Apprentice. He used to host Loveline with Dr. Drew. Well, Adam Carolla found himself in hot water back in 2011. I don't know if you remember this. We actually did cover this on the show. Adam Carolla, back in 2011, he had some anti-gay jokes. One of them was that the LGBT acronym should be changed to Yuck, because that's apparently funny. And he gave this grudging apology at the time. And he said that comedians should get a pass when it comes to homophobic statements. He said, quote, "We are comedians. We're supposed to say these things. I'm not saying hurtful things. We make no policies. I don't control anything. I just tell jokes." It was this grudging apology. Well, now, he's got a new book coming out, and he did this interview with Salon Magazine. And he said in this interview, he's still so upset about that 2011 brouhaha when he was called to task for his comments. He said, this is his new quote, that the LGBT community has, quote, "turned into a mafia demanding everyone apologize for every joke and retract every statement." So apparently the LGBT community is a mafia. And he cites his career success as proof that he isn't anti-gay. He said, quote, "If you can't work with gay people, you're going to have a difficult time in Hollywood. There's plenty of gay people, and they're in positions above you. If you're anti-gay, you're not going to get your movie directed." And by the way, I'm not even going to read the rest of this interview, but he went on to say the most ridiculous stuff. He talked about these systemic disadvantages for racial minorities. It's this interview where you have to wonder, where was your PR person? Because isn't that the point at which your PR person swoops in and says, no, 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 this interview's over, Adam's done talking, everyone buy his book. Because he kept going and he said these really racially insensitive things. But this whole thing about how he was called to task and the LGBT community is the mafia and you can't say anything, well, that's not really true, Adam Carolla. The LGBT community is not the mafia. If your words were not in opposition to what public sentiment largely believes, then any LGBT rights organization that demands an apology would just be an outlier. They would be an outlier. It wouldn't make a difference if they demanded an apology, because the large-scale American public would say, yeah, you know what, we don't want an apology from Adam Carolla. That was funny and it wasn't offensive. But the fact is, you did put jokes out there that were offensive. The LGBT community and the LGBT organizations that are media rights watch organizations and ask for apologies when things are hurtful. Yes, they quite naturally ask for an apology. You then gave one because it was very clear that the public at large found your comments to be distasteful. It's not a mafia thing, my friend Adam Carolla. It's not a mafia thing. It's that your comments were at odds with public sentiment, and thus you issued an apology because you knew that. So that's Adam Carolla. You can buy his new book if you want to. That's your choice. Now, turning to education, a couple education stories for you. Now, the Common Core. The Common Core is a set of educational standards promoted by the Obama administration, and Republicans all over the country are just up in arms about the Common Core. They don't like the Common Core. Well, a Florida Republican, he has said that he believes the Common Core standards will turn kids, yes, you guessed it, gay. Yep. The new educational standards promoted by the Obama administration, they're going to turn kids gay. These remarks were made at an anti-Common Core event in March. They were just posted by the blog Think Progress this week. Republican State Representative Charles Van Zandt said the group implementing the Common Core in Florida, and the group is the American Institutes for Research, which, by the way, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group. But this is what State Representative Charles Van Zandt said. He said the group will, quote, promote double-mindedness in state education and attract every one of your children to become as homosexual as they possibly can. I'm sorry to report that to you, but you need to know, end quote. Holy cow, so excited that I have the opportunity to read that again. I'm going to do that right now. State Representative Charles Van Zandt said that these Common Core standards, as promoted by the American Institutes for Research, they will, quote, promote double-mindedness in state education and attract every one of your children to become as homosexual as they possibly can. I'm sorry to report that to you, but you need to know, end quote. I don't even know what the standards are for becoming as homosexual as you could possibly be. I don't think that I lived up to those standards when I was in K-12 education. So the idea that the Common Core, maybe just there in Florida, maybe just through the American Institutes for Research, is going to require that your children become as homosexual as they possibly can be, that's a really high standard, and I think I would have failed. I do love the part, by the way, of the quote where State Representative Charles Van Zandt is quite reluctant. He's quite reluctant to tell you these things. He said, quote, I'm sorry to report that to you, but you need to know. He doesn't want to pull back the curtain and let you all know that your kids are going to become as homosexual as they can possibly be. Or maybe they won't become as homosexual as they could possibly be. It's just that the standards will require that they be as homosexual as they could possibly be. But he's reluctant to tell that to you. He wishes that that both weren't the case and that you heard it from somebody else. So I appreciate your reluctance, State Representative Charles Van Zandt. I appreciate it. But you did pull back the curtain, and now we are on the alert. We are on the alert. In college news, and we did cover this story a few months ago. So what was happening in South Carolina? In South Carolina, the House voted to take away roughly $70,000 of funding from two public colleges over the assignment of LGBT-inclusive reading material. The reading material at question, it consisted of lesbian cartoonist Alison Bechdel's acclaimed graphic memoir, Fun Home, a Family Tragicomic, which was selected by the University of South Carolina's Upstate as part of their optional freshman reading list. It also included gay poet and professor Ed Madden's Out Loud, The Best of Rainbow Radio, which was assigned by the College of Charleston as their summer reading for their English 101 course. So in retaliation, the House voted to cut $17,000 from USC Upstate's funding and $52,000 from the College of Charleston state allocation. Well, now the Senate this week, they went along with a committee's recommendation to restore the roughly $70,000 in funding, but they added Senator Larry Groom's amendment, which regulated how the funds are spent. Okay? They have now said, if you are going to use these funds, the money must be spent on courses about the U.S. Constitution and other founding documents. So the U.S. Constitution and founding documents, which guarantee free speech, you must use the money on that rather than, you know, using the money on the free speech of assigning optional LGBT books. I mean, great that you're restoring the funding, but seriously? You're saying exactly how the money needs to be spent in a classic display of irony? So weird. So weird. I'm in the process right now of creating my reading list for the course that I am teaching in the fall called This Course is So Gay. It's like a brand. This show is so gay. That's my radio show. You're listening to it right now. This dissertation is so gay. That's my dissertation. That's actually what it's called. It's in the Library of Congress. I swear I'm not making that up. So I'm developing the reading list for This Course is So Gay, and the idea that I could select books that might put Baldwin Wallace University's funding at jeopardy, I can't imagine that that would actually happen, and also that would be really self-centered that I would think that as I'm selecting books. But I don't think these professors were thinking that either, that they were selecting books that would put public funding at jeopardy for their entire university. That is just so insane. And for the government to then turn around and say, we'll give you the money back, so long as you use the money on this, crazy, crazy, crazy that these things happen in education. Well, that is the big old rundown of everything happening in the gay world these days. Even though I'm headed to AIDS Lifecycle, we still have amazing original content coming at you in the next couple of weeks. We have incredible, incredible guests. We will have the Rhodey coordinator for AIDS Lifecycle, Eric Kenny. He will be on the show next week, and we'll be talking about that event and how you guys can get involved. We will also have Nick Searley, who is part of the duo The Skivvies, an amazing New York City duo. They just got written up in People magazine, so Nick's going to be on the show, and he's going to be talking about all the great things that he is doing. If you guys have any guest suggestions, you know you should not be hesitating to reach out to me. Just send any of your guest suggestions on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, or you can post them on our Twitter account. The handle is thisshowisogay, or you can post them on our Facebook page, wherever you want to get in touch with us and give me ideas for guests. I'm always looking for new guests. Always, always, always. And don't just send RuPaul's Drag Racers. I love having RuPaul's Drag Racers on the show, but there are all these other folks out there too. So send your ideas on over to me. In the meantime, get out there, folks. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters, whether you are volunteering with your statewide organization, whether you are giving $10 to an AIDS Lifecycle participant. It could even be me. Just go to AIDSLifecycle.org and just donate $10 right there. Whether you are supporting Clay Aiken's run, whether you are developing a reading list for your LGBT course, whatever it is that you do, you know what you do best. I don't know what it is. You do. It's your strength. Follow your strength. Follow your passion to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there in the world making a huge difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
The song is called Viola.
Like when you turn.